Hello and welcome to A Good Science Read. My guest today is Professor Dinah Birch, Emeritus Professor of English Literature at the University of Liverpool and until recently Pro Vice-Chancellor for Cultural Engagement. Her speciality is Victorian literature, especially the works of John Ruskin and Anthony Trollope, and she has a particular interest in prose style. She's a regular broadcaster and contributor to the Times Literary Supplement and the London Review of Books, and was a member of the Man Booker Prize Committee in 2012. She has recently published a book on Trollope in the very short introduction series. Dinah, welcome to A Good Science Read.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
So today we're going to discuss two books which seem to me to illustrate the very best in popular science writing. The first of these is A Faber Book of Science, edited by John Carey. It's a wonderful anthology that showcases some of the very best of popular science writing, and each extract is introduced by comments and explanations from Carey, and they cover topics as diverse as medieval lice, stardust, protons, butterfly collecting, and the colour of radium. Carey also provides a marvellous introductory piece on popular science writing. I must say, this is one of my all-time favourite books. Did you enjoy it, Dinah?
I enjoyed it hugely, and I have admired it, in fact, for many years. I think it is a brilliant collection. First appeared in 1995, so things have moved on in some respects, but it has worn very well, and it's certainly still worth anyone's time. It's a very varied selection. Not all of the pieces were written, in fact, for public consumption. He has fascinating extracts, for instance, from Da Vinci's notebooks, which predate popular science writing, but are so interesting that they certainly earn their place in the book. But Carey's central argument is that popular science writing is a relatively new genre. And he traces its development in a series of wonderfully winning pieces. The introduction in itself is well worth reading and well worth thinking about. What Carey's saying is the kind of writing that he values and the extracts, the pieces that he's chosen, reflect and represent what he calls the instructed imagination. And I just love that phrase, the instructed imagination.
It's brilliant, isn't it? He also says that the pieces he chose were based on two criteria, I think. Do you want to read it twice? And does it supply the scientific knowledge that you need to understand it? Do you think he succeeded?
I really do. I think what makes Carey uniquely qualified to make this selection is that he is a brilliantly talented literary critic, and he has an eye for good writing, vivid writing, strong writing, of a kind that engages the reader. And there isn't a piece in this book that doesn't engage the reader. Nor is there a piece that you don't learn from. He manages to fuse those two ambitions. And he insists, and I do think this is important, that the pieces should not only be instructive, the instructed imagination, but give pleasure. And I think that's crucial to the success of the book. But he does go a little bit further, and I think in a very interesting and still important way, in making a distinction between two different kinds of science writing. What he calls the explanatory mode, which is the mode he favours most, which give you as a reader an insight into scientific method, the way in which the insights that the extracts describe have been reached. And that is still, I think, really at the centre of good science writing. But he also mentions what he calls the mind-stretching mode, which he summarises as and this is a memorable phrase again, the G Whiz school of writing. In other words, that's designed to elicit amazement, astonishment, a sense of wonder in the reader. And that's a different kind of science writing. And the best science writing combines those two modes. Carey does favour the explanatory mode, but he concedes that there's a place for gee-whizzery.
Yes, but I think, actually, that sometimes explanations provoke the sense of wonder because there is so much out there which is totally amazing. And when you understand it a little bit more, then it becomes even more extraordinary. And you're right about how he has... some of the pieces are very explanatory, but at the same time, they can also be quite lyrical. My favourite piece, for example, was Shedding Life by Miroslav Hollop, where the science is explained in detail, but it's also beautifully written. I mean, he was not only an immunologist, but he was also a poet, wasn't he? And I discovered, actually, that he has the unique distinction of having a minor planet in the asteroid belt named after him. Did you like that bit?
It was my favourite too. Mm-hmm. We coincide. And I think you're absolutely right in saying that that very good science writing does both. It evokes astonishment and wonder, but it also explains. And certainly, and that's true of this piece, Shedding Life. I will say that Hollop, who is a very capable scientist, was a brilliant poet. And again, there really aren't many people who can claim distinction in both poetry and professional science. Indeed, I was trying to think of others that would be true of, and I couldn't really come up with a name.
But it's quite interesting because John Carey makes this point in the introduction, doesn't he? That actually he was unable to find much good poetry about science. And I think, actually, you know, Miroslav Hollob does write some of his poetry about science, but a lot of it is, it's more about different things.
Indeed. And even the poems that are about science, and indeed they are about science, and sometimes very revealingly so, but they're not really altogether about science. In my experience of reading Hollob, I haven't read every poem, but I've read a good deal of Hollob. He's in the end taking science back to human values and indeed humane values. And that's what's so remarkable about this piece, that it's full of science that is astonishing, but it's not without a human context or indeed a moral context. And that's very important to Hollob's ambition, and it's one of the things that makes it, I think, unforgettable.
Perhaps we should say something about what it's actually about.
Indeed,
I mean, it's about the it's about the death of a muskrat, which was hiding in his empty swimming pool, and before he could rescue it, his neighbour came along and shot it, and it was left to die in a pool of blood. And Hollob describes how death is kind of an extinction by stages, and that even though the brain has stopped working, the individual cells continue to go on living for longer. And many of them are desperately sending out alarm signals to other tissues. And the blood cells are trying to form a clot and the immune cells are trying to defend against invaders. And it's an incredibly active death, yeah, really. He has this wonderful quote: "The muskrat was still, in a sense, running around the pool in search of itself. The shed blood shows that there is not one death, but a whole stream of little deaths of varying degrees and significances."
It's brilliantly done. And it makes you realise that death isn't an instant. It is a process. A process that the muskrat lying insensible in the pool exemplifies. And there is, in those passages that you've just quoted, a sense of deep pathos. He humanises the process without compromising in any sense the scientific accuracy of what he is describing. The blood is the muskrat's secret life forced out.
That's beautiful, isn't it? I love that phrase.
Yeah. I mean, he talks about the red blood cells attempting to form clots, as you said, coagulating. Their hemoglobin molecules puzzled as to how and where to pass their four oxygen molecules. And that's such a brilliant way of putting it, because the condition of being puzzled, of course, it's not altogether appropriate to a molecule. No molecule can really be said to be puzzled in quite the sense we usually use that word, but it's exactly right for what he is describing.
But I think that's one of the things about writing for the general reader, because animizing things actually helps you in understanding. If you were writing a scientific paper, you would not write it that way. It would be a red line straight through it. But on the other hand, if you're describing this and you want to generate a sense of emotion in your reader, then this is the perfect way to do it.
Indeed. And he does it repeatedly, not in a way that I think is intrusive as you're learning about the processes, but again, talking about the white blood cells still valiantly trying to do their job, but they are bewildered. It's the perfect word. And it means that you really do engage with what that death means, the death of a fellow creature. It's something that has importance, that it matters.
Yes, and it also matters that it is an extinction by stages. I mean, he doesn't actually say this, but of course this is the basis of all transplant. Without the fact that things die at different rates, we wouldn't be able to make transplants. Yeah.
So death isn't a single event, but a whole stream of what he calls tiny deaths. And it is unforgettable. I don't think that we are unique, Fran, in identifying this as our favourite passage. This is still a much read anthology, and I've mentioned it to one or two people. And this is the passage they come back to. They say, oh, I remember that bit about the muskrat in the swimming pool. So it makes a real impact.
Yes, because you're not just sorry about the death of the muskrat. It's all these other things which are also dying and are desperately trying to, you know, marshal the troops.
And Hollab overlays that with a point about the futility of the death. There was no need for the neighbour to have shot the muskrat. It was wrong. There is, within that scientific account, there is a moral drive. It is wrong to take life randomly in this way. And he makes that point, I think, very eloquently. It has a human dimension alongside the scientific explanation. Not everyone is a poet, not everyone can do this, but Hollab does it so brilliantly here.
Yes, we should probably mention one or two of the other passages in the book.
Possibly.
Obviously, we haven't time to go into them all. I think one of the ones that I particularly remembered was the one by Lewis Wolpert called Unnatural Nature. And this considers how science is often counterintuitive. For example, if you drop a bullet from your hand and fire another one horizontally, perfectly straight, from a gun at exactly the same time, which will hit the ground first? And I think many people think that the bullet dropped on the ground will hit the ground first. But in fact, they both hit the ground at the same time, because a bullet's rate of fall is caused by gravity and is quite independent of the horizontal motion. And I, of course, should have known this, but I actually bet that the bullet dropped from your hand would hit the ground first. And so I was very provoked by this, which I think is another thing about these marvellous pieces here. I thought I'd better go and check it out on Google, and I found the most wonderful YouTube video with two crazy guys actually doing the experiment. And of course, the physics was right.
It's interesting that you should say that, going to Google to follow it up, because I do think that that is another mark of good popular science writing. You read something in an extract like that and you think, blimey, and you want to learn more. And it is now, of course, as you've just said, it's very possible. There are so many sources of information. And since we agreed, Fran, that we would do this podcast, I've been ferreting about here and there, looking at other extracts, as you say, YouTube videos. I'm a much better informed woman than when we began. But that is a hallmark of writing that really does engage you. You feel it's not enough. It whets your appetite. And the Walpert piece is a very good example, which underlines that crucial point that it is not safe to rely on what we are sometimes tempted to think is so dependable, common sense. Common sense will lead you up all kinds of garden path if you're not careful, if you don't really examine in the way that scientists will the basis for your assumptions. Scientists depend on experiment, not on instinct, and their conclusions are not always, but really very often counterintuitive. And Walpert has a very sober tone, winning but sober, does come up with some gee whiz facts, like the molecules in water. I was very struck by the example he begins with, that pouring your glass of water into the ocean, and the way in which he can then demonstrate that there are more molecules in a glass of water than there are glasses of water in the ocean, because the molecule will be there in any glass that you pull up. I haven't explained that as well as Walpert does, but it's a very striking fact. And again, I thought, that can't be true. But it is true.
Yes, and you went and looked it up, of course. I mean, it is sort of provoking and inspirational, isn't it? Many of these pieces. I think John Carey actually says that his favourite example of a scientific principle being exposed and clarified in this way is On Being the Right Size by Haldane. Did you like that piece?
It's a lovely piece. It's an early example, in fact, of popular science. Haldane, again, was very distinguished a scientist, and we remember him as a scientist, but he wrote for the workers, to enlighten the workers in a number of publications. He thought that that was a responsibility. This piece dates from 1927, and it is a very winning piece. It explains, for instance, how the giants, Pope and Pagan, in Bunyan's Pilgrim's Progress, couldn't have existed in nature because their bones would have broken, their leg bones would have broken under their own weight.
Yes, every time they took a step.
Exactly. And one of the things I took from that, again, I followed this up a little, is that none of us need worry about being attacked by a giant tarantula 6 feet tall, because such a tarantula could not exist in the natural world. It wouldn't be able to breathe without a different anatomy. And that, I think, is a revelation that sheds light on all sorts of popular fiction science, where things move through different size ranges in ways that would simply be impossible in the natural world. Of course, that isn't altogether the point of those giants in Bunyan's allegory. They're there for different reasons, to represent tyranny and ignorance, forces which have not vanished away. But as a natural phenomenon, that's not going to work. And I think that that's very interesting. And I loved, I don't know how you felt about this, Fran, the example of the size of the eye.
Yes, I thought that was interesting, but I found the business about the size of the insects not being able to grow larger fascinating, because, of course, insects were so much larger in prehistoric times. And you immediately wonder why that could happen. And then you realise, if you go and look it up, that, of course, the oxygen concentration in the atmosphere was much greater then. So it was easier for the oxygen to diffuse along their breathing tubes.
Indeed, yes. And so they weren't enormous, but they were significantly larger. Yes, they could manage without lungs at a larger size because there was more oxygen.
I think the other thing is, in this same piece, there's another bit which is not about being the right size, but about splitting the atom, about nuclear fission. And this was written in 1939, and he speculates it's going to have a massive effect on world economy and world order, as power is going to be available in large quantities. And those countries which have lots of uranium deposits will do very well indeed. He didn't, of course, foresee the problem of nuclear waste, but he does say, fortunately, uranium bombs cannot at once be adapted for war, as the apparatus needed is very heavy and also very delicate, so it cannot at present be dropped from an aeroplane. But doubtless uranium will be used for killing in some way. I think that's very prescient because the atom bomb was dropped only 6 years later.
Yeah, very prescient and very sad. He also says that coal miners will all be out of a job. It's not true. There are still many, many people in China where they are mining coal at a phenomenal rate, partly to manufacture steel. Still many, many people earning their living as coal miners. And so although we don't now have a coal mining industry in the Western world, it is still happening so many years after Haldane predicted that we would no longer have a need.
Yes, and actually it has very deleterious effects on people's health when it's used as a fuel. Because I was reading only today that in Mongolia, so many people are dying as a consequence of lung problems caused by the fact that they have so much coal smog there.
Yes, indeed, as used to be the case in this country.
Yes, exactly.
It is a human outrage that this is still the case.
So we have only time to mention very briefly one more example. Do you want to pick one?
Yes, I do. I want to pick Faraday's lecture on a candle. It's the final lecture in a series of six. Dates from 1848, which was a moment of great change in culture. It was the year of revolution. Things were shifting. And Faraday was a pioneer, which is really why I think he deserves a mention, in feeling it a responsibility and a privilege, as he once put it, to communicate science to a much wider audience. He's really, as far as I can see, the first serious practitioner of this new literary genre. And
yes,
lecture in itself remains of interest. We would use a different terminology now. He doesn't talk about oxygen. He doesn't talk about carbon dioxide. He talks about air and carbonic acid. But the analogy that he draws between the burning of a candle and human life remains, I think, very striking. And one final point to mention about Faraday, I think Faraday was a hero, really, is that he, again, as far as I know, almost for the first time, emphasises our mutual dependence, not just on our fellow creatures, but, as he puts it, on our fellow existers, that we need plants, not as a source for exploitation, but at a very basic level of chemical process. We need what plants do for us. And again, like so many of these pieces, it does end with a note of kind of moral appeal. You know, let's try and live well. Let's try to live like candles in the sense that we are conferring benefit to, as he puts it, our fellow men.
But of course, his audience was actually children.
Yeah.
Because this was the marvellous thing. He instituted the Christmas lectures, which still go on extraordinarily. And they were so popular, I don't know if you know this, but it led to the implementation of the first one-way street, because the carriages got so jammed up trying to collect people and deliver people.
Good for Faraday.
So then I think we should probably move on to the second book, which is The Golden Mole and Other Living Treasures by Catherine Rundell. And it's a celebration of 22 endangered species, written in what I consider to be wonderful prose. I'll be interested to see what you think. And it's full of strange and fascinating facts. It has been very popular and was shortlisted for numerous prizes, including the Wainwright Prize for Nature Writing and both Waterstones and Foyle's Book of the Year. And as with the Faber Book of Science, we can only discuss one or two of the stories she covers. Which was your favourite, Dinah?
It's hard to choose, because every one of these short pieces is a marvellous piece of writing discussing a still more marvellous creature. So if I really had to pick a favourite, I think it would be the section on the elephant. So that might be special pleading, as I have always been especially fascinated by elephants. So to go back to your point, what is special about her prose? Why is it so engaging? It seems to me what makes her approach so distinctive and so appealing is the way she catches your attention with the quirky and the unexpected, whilst also giving you a very solid sense of the characteristics of the creature that she is discussing. You do feel better informed, or I do, at the end of each of these sections. And not only does she communicate the uniqueness of each of her subjects, what makes it wonderful, she also talks about its connections with humanity, often stretching back over centuries. The book is about how we used to perceive the natural world and its many inhabitants, drawing on myth, legend, history, literature, folklore, alongside how we might respond now. So in that piece about the elephant, as one example, she begins with a doleful story about two elephants in a zoo in Paris being shot for food in the 1870 siege. So it's an upsetting story about a miserable period in human history. And over again, in different ways, it's not a repetitive book, but she does emphasise the vulnerability of the creatures she describes, even creatures as huge and powerful as an elephant, and what they are especially vulnerable to is us. So this is a book with a purpose that is different to that of John Carey's anthology. It has been written to entertain and to delight and to instruct. It has that in common with Carey's collection. But it's also there to warn and to make us feel the scale of the threat we all pose to the diversity of life on Earth.
I think that's right. And my favourite piece is, of course, the one on the hare, because I have hares in the field at the bottom of my garden and I love to watch them. But they're massively in decline because of destruction, mainly of their habitat and hunting. And I love her idea that she says, those who have profited from the destruction of such places should be made to live in a motorway service station their whole lives.
Yes.
And she goes on to say that the hare is the only game that you can legally shoot all year round, even in the mating season. That's quite extraordinary, and it's not true in Europe. that Baroness Helleck has introduced a private member's bill just last November to protect hares in the mating season. There's no date yet for the second reading, but I do hope it goes through. And I'd like to encourage anybody listening to this podcast to write to their MP to support the bill, because they are the most beautiful and fascinating creatures.
They are wonderful. They are, of course, so elegant, a word that Rundle uses, so resilient. They've been with us for centuries. Unlike the rabbit, brought over by the Romans, though they've been here a while, but the hare has been here still longer. And your point about habitat, we had fields at the back of our house where skylarks bred and hares ran. Quite a lot of hares, as it happens, and a surprising number of skylarks. And as we speak, Fran, those fields are being built over for a new housing development, the mantra of our new government, and I can see why. Build, build, build. And that is what is happening, particularly in the southeast of England. And it chips away, field by field, bit by bit, chips away at the homes of the hares and the skylarks. And it is very hard to resist. We did try, my neighbours and I, we protested, made the case for the skylarks. We joined together, we pointed out what would happen to the hares, but it was, of course, to no avail. And I see that people need somewhere to live, and the economic growth that the government needs, so we're being told constantly, can't happen without accommodation. But I do think that Rundle makes this point repeatedly, we are, when it comes to the point, despite lip service we may pay, when it comes to the point, we put human interest before our responsibility to the natural world over and over and over again, and we still do it.
Yes, I agree. And I fantasise, actually, that this anthology is rather like the Ark. It's a collection of rare and beautiful creatures that we need to save before they all go extinct, due to this, as you point out, seemingly inexorable march of progress and house building and so on. And Rundle makes an impassioned plea at the end of the book to say that we need to act now if we're going to save all these wonderful, strange and remarkable creatures that she talks about from extinction.
She makes a number of good suggestions. It has a practical dimension, this book. We should support environmental charities. We should keep our footprint on the natural environment as light as possible, campaign for change, educate ourselves and others. Will it be enough? We can only try, and we have a duty to try. We mustn't just surrender. But there is a sense in which, and this is where the book, which I like very much, is so different from Carey, that alongside the pleasure that it gives, and it's given me a good deal of pleasure, is a thrumming undertow of sadness, which doesn't go away. Because, to be frank, I don't see any sign that this process of destruction is stopping or even slowing. Climate change, economic imperatives, pollution, I mean, you know the list as well as I do, and it's a long list of forces that conspire against biodiversity and the flourishing of the natural world.
It's terribly different from what it was like when I was a child. I just have to look in the hedgerows at the different flowers that are there. When I was a child, the hedgerows in Dorset were absolutely yellow with primroses, and there was stitchwort and violets and, oh, the most beautiful things. And now in the Oxford hedgerows, there's just grass. And it's so, so sad, I think.
But lest we're too gloomy, I do share your melancholy. But nature is very resilient. And I've been noticing over recent years the prevalence of Danish scurvy grass. Do you know about Danish?
No, I don't.
It's a hero species. It's native to this country, despite its being Danish as well. No doubt it flourishes in Denmark. It's a member of the Brassica family, and it flourishes on coastlines, and it has an ability to expel salt from its cells because it's evolved near the sea. It lives on beaches, really, and so it copes very well with drought, and it doesn't need very much nutrition. And so if you, in April, and we're in April as I speak, drive about, as I'm afraid I do from time to time, the highways and byways of England, you will find in full flower the Danish scurvy grass, in flower and flourishing. It was used, it's called scurvy grass. I've been Googling. It's called scurvy grass because sailors knew that if they ate it, it would help with symptoms of scurvy. Because like all of the Brassica family, it's full of vitamin C. They didn't know why it helped, but they knew it did. So when I think we're all doomed and the whole of nature will die, I think, well, not the Danish scurvy grass.
Well, I think that would be wonderful then if Catherine Rundle, who has this lyrical turn of phrase, was to write another book, but this time not about remarkable animals, but about flowers and plants as a kind of partner to the one that she's already done. I think before we finish, we should just say a few more words about this book because it is so wonderful. And I would like to mention a couple of things. The first is to go back to the hare, which is what we got distracted about, is that I had no idea that hares could carry two different pregnancies at the same time, and that despite the hare being pregnant, she could be fertilised by the male again during her pregnancy, and that the embryos would sort of wait in the oviduct, partly developing until the womb had been evacuated by the birth of the first set of hares, and then they could move down in. And that, of course, enables them to breed many more times in a season than would happen if they had to wait, as, for example, we do, until the pregnancy had finished. So that's has the wonderful name of superfetation. But I think that's a completely fascinating thing that many people probably don't know about.
Most people don't know. Certainly I didn't know. And like you, I was very taken with that. But Catherine Rundle is very interesting about processes of mating, fertility, fecundity. I didn't know, for instance, a comparable fact, that it is the male seahorse and not the female that gives birth to the young of the species. That was a new one on me, and for similar reasons, to improve the life chances of the young. The female deposits her eggs in a kind of pouch, specialised pouch that the male has at the front of his abdomen, and they develop there, and he's in charge. She swims off, takes no further interest in the process, but she then begins to develop more eggs while he looks after the developing young that, when the time is right, burst out of this pouch in a kind of spectacular shower. That was new to me.
Yes, it's wonderful, isn't it? It's a way, I suppose, of maximising your energy sources for producing young. And there was a wonderful one in the story of the Greenland shark, which is another favourite of mine, where she says that the strongest fetus eats the other siblings in the womb. So quite extraordinary. And of course, they are amazing, those Greenland sharks, because they live for so long. They're the longest lived vertebrate on the planet. They can live for somewhere between 250 and 500 years. It's just they do so at a very slow rate.
They're so mysterious. This was one of my favourite sections too. The Greenland shark, the females, again, take 150 years to reach sexual maturity. That's a long time to wait for a family.
Yes, it is.
And so much we don't know about them. And that's a point that recurs in this book, and it's an important point. We think we're so well informed about the natural world. We have throngs of biologists and environmentalists. But the more we learn, and professional scientists in the field would all say this, the more we learn, the more we come to understand that we know so little. And we don't understand the scale of what we're destroying. We don't know how many Greenland sharks there are. We don't know how long they are able to live.
That's particularly true of things like insects and, of course, bacteria. I mean, there are stories these days of people just analysing the viruses in a small collection of, water, and you suddenly discover that there are all of these ones which you have no idea about. So it's a worry that they're all dying out so quickly before we have time to even find out about them.
One of many worries. And another winning feature of this terrific book is that Catherine Rundle does not limit her attention to the cute and the cuddly, and that Greenland shark is a miraculous creature, but no one could call it cuddly. And one of the sections I enjoyed most was that on the spider. And I have to confess I'm not especially fond of spiders, but Rundle went a long way towards changing my mindset. And as ever, there are threatened spiders. We tend to think spiders are doing fine. We seem to be besieged by spiders in my house. But it's not altogether true. And there is a creature called the gooty tarantula, which is a gorgeous shade of blue. And again, on Google, there I was on Google, learning all about the gooty tarantula. It is a spectacularly lovely creature and critically endangered. It's tempting to think that, you know, we can do without spiders, but that would be a huge error. They're very important to the overall ecosystem, the balance of life. They're a crucial food source for many birds. They consume some of the pests that otherwise we would be overwhelmed by or have to deal with in other more destructive ways. They pollinate plants. They are creatures of virtue. And really, I did feel much more warmly disposed to the spider family after I'd read that section.
You know, it's interesting. Most popular science is written by practicing scientists or people who were trained as scientists, at least the popular science writing which we have today. But it's really interesting that neither of the authors of these two books is a scientist. And John Carey remarks in his introduction, "If readers ask, as well they might, what I, a professor of literature, think I am up to editing a science anthology, my answer is that I've done it for pleasure, self-fulfillment, and in Coleridge's words, the gratification of knowing." I love that last phrase.
Yes, it's a very good phrase. But it is true that it's always been true, actually, but it is increasingly true, I think, that educated people, scientists, people more engaged with the humanities do now have an appetite for what we might describe as shared territory. Popular science, just from the publishing perspective, is an enormously rapidly expanding section of the book trade. If you go into a bookshop now, you will find more popular science books than novels.
That's very interesting. I didn't know that.
Yeah.
So this podcast serves a role then.
Indeed it does. We mustn't exaggerate. There have always been areas of shared interest. We mentioned Faraday and the popularity of those Christmas lectures still persisting. But in fact, throughout the 19th century, before we had the internet, before we had television, when books were harder to come by, lecturers would go up and down the land talking about scientific issues, and they were immensely popular. So it's not an entirely new phenomenon that people do have an appetite to be better informed. And I think it's a very, very wholesome phenomenon.
I completely agree with you, but it's, I'm afraid, all we have time for today. So my thanks to my guest, Professor Dinah Birch. The books we have been discussing are The Faber Book of Science, edited by John Carey, published by Faber and Faber in 1995, and The Golden Mole by Catherine Rundle, published by Faber and Faber, again, in 2022. You can catch up with more suggestions for a good science read on our podcasts, which can be found on the Oxford University website or wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you for listening.